Well, hello there, it's Antrice, and welcome to another episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast. The Savvy Painter Podcast is published every other week. If you are a painter who is looking for down-to-earth, real-life conversations about art, how to create it, and how to sell it, you are in the right place. Savvy Painter has been downloaded over 1.5 million times by artists in 150 countries. This is the place where you will find your community. You'll be inspired to create, and you'll hear real stories from artists who are thriving with their art. So if you are new to this podcast, I want to welcome you to the Savvy Painter community. But make sure that you don't miss an episode. Sign up for weekly updates, free guides, and workshop announcements. Just go to savvypainter.com/subscribe. It's that easy. My guest this week is the artist Adam Hall. Adam is a painter out of Nashville, Tennessee, where he lives with his wife and three children. He paints large-scale landscapes, many including ocean scenes, and in this episode, Adam talks about why he has such a strong pull to paint the ocean. We also talk about how he worked his way from the music industry into a full-time painter, how he taught himself to paint, how he and his wife ensure that they both have time for their careers and their children, and how becoming a father only strengthened his drive to be a painter. Adam also talks about his inspirations, and because of him, I took another look at Gerhard Richter's landscape paintings. It's been a long while since I've spent any time looking at them, so thank you, Adam, for inspiring me to dive down that rabbit hole. If you are listening to this episode at release time, Adam has a show up at Robert Lang Studios in Charleston, South Carolina that runs until November 22nd, 2019. And there'll be a link in the show notes if you want to swing by to see Adam's work in person. Before we get started, though, if you follow me on Instagram, you might know that we recently brought not one, but two puppies into our family. They are adorable 8-week-old German Shepherds, and I really hoped that they would sleep through our interview, but they had other plans, and they were determined to make their debut in the podcast, so you'll probably hear them a little bit in the background. Huge thank you to Adam for taking all that ruckus in a stride. So let's jump into our conversation with the artist Adam Hall. Hello, Adam. Welcome to the Savvy Painter Podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you for having me. As I was saying to you earlier, this is surreal talking to you in real time. I'm a huge fan of your interviews and the content you're putting out and very inspired by your commitment to it. So thank you.
Awesome. Thank you. Tell me a little bit about your work and how you brought yourself into this crazy vocation that we're in.
Yeah, that's definitely a crazy world for sure, a crazy pursuit. So I originally, in my pursuit of a creative path, was drawn to music, moved to Nashville. This is where I live now, and was terrified of the idea of going to school for art because I was like, I felt like it was like going to be wasting my folks' money. Like, how am I ever going to have a job that makes sense with paying off loans or and all that sort of thing? And so the next idea I had was, well, I love music too. So why don't I study music business? And I minored in music performance. And I was always painting on the side, as most people do, as just like another outlet and a hobby, something for fun. And did that all throughout college and kept pursuing music. And eventually, out of college, I went on the road with bands, traveling, doing road managing. I don't know if you're familiar with Christian music at all. There's a band called Petra. They were like the pioneers of long hair rock Christian music, so much so that like when they came out, people, like the church and people, thought it was like devil music. I didn't grow up listening to Christian music at all, so I had no idea who they were, but they're like a pretty big deal in that whole world. And so I was doing road managing with them. And every time I was back from tour, I had this little corner set up in my house. We had like a bachelor pad and I would paint there. And so basically there's like kind of two events that I guess is probably worth mentioning that brought me into that aha moment of like, oh, like art can be, this can work on a level of sustaining my living expenses and like all that sort of thing. Like I could see the finish line with it. and I guess you could call it like Africa and tornadoes. Like those are the two events. And so when I was on tour with that band, Petra, we had a partnership with an organization called Food for the Hungry. I had a great relationship with them. And when I got off tour, I didn't really know what to do with my life. And I was painting these weird paintings of portraits of my roommate playing music and stuff. So I jumped on this trip going to Africa for like 3.5-4 weeks. And I could talk like an hour just about the crazy things that happened on that trip. But then I got back from Africa and had all that stuff that had happened pent up inside. And so shortly thereafter, all these tornadoes came through Tennessee and just destroyed this area called Gallatin, Tennessee, which is like 20 minutes away from Nashville or something. And so me and a group of my buddies went down to the American Red Cross, put our finger on the map, got chainsaws, and ended up at this guy's house, who just happened to be David Wright, who is like a very well-established frontier artist. I didn't know this at the time. And then like we worked all throughout the day. And then at lunchtime, he was like, oh, come down to my studio for some waters and sandwiches. And I was thinking maybe this, because the property was really nice, I thought maybe he's like an old producer or engineer or something. And so when we walked in his studio, my mouth just dropped and I immediately knew who he was because I'd seen his work in certain parts of Tennessee. And he does these huge murals of like Daniel Boone and war reenactments. And he was working on these like to scale life-size portraits of Native Americans. And he's friends with the actor who was in Last of the Mohicans, who played the antagonist that was like out to get Daniel Day-Lewis. And so he was doing these like portraits of him in the full headdress and like all that. And so I just geeked out over this. It was just an insane chance encounter. And so he gave me some advice, and I wish I had written it down, but I was the typical annoying, like young artist who was like, oh my gosh, like what paints are you using? Like, how are you mixing that color? Like, what's your materials? What surface are you painting? Like, I was like asking him all these questions, and he was super gracious with me. He gave me a bunch of advice about how he had maintained his career as an artist, starting out as like an illustrator and like different paths and decisions he made along the way. And then I was like, hey, we'll come back next week and help you finish all this. But internally, it was like all selfish, like intentions of like just to come back there and get more sit down time with him. So anyway, he basically said something like, I sent him my work and he said, you should try something completely different. You should try maybe a landscape or just straying away from looking at like a photo reference and just create something that's in you. And so my girlfriend, who's my wife at the time, like a few days after this event happened and I had come back from Africa, bought me as a surprise gift a 54-inch by 54-inch canvas. And I'd never painted anything even close to that size. And so I'd painted what I felt from my experience from Africa. Like I just let it all out on canvas, and it ended up being a landscape from memory of a place and time there. And it was the first time where I felt myself like smiling as I was painting. It was like the first time I stepped back and thought like this had like some soul to it. And so that was like an aha moment of like, wow, like in this kind of like crazy crowded forest of creativity, I found like the clearing and the path of like the way to go, at least for this season. And so the next step was like, okay, now like I've figured out what I want to do. Like, how do I make this like financially rewarding in some way so I can keep doing it? And so being in Nashville, it's very like, back then at least, an up and coming artist, a young artist, like there's not a big gallery scene here. But I knew that if I reached out to like interior designers, that it might work. And so I went into all these interior designers with no portfolio, and they all said no and kind of laughed me out of the place. And then a buddy of mine introduced me to this big name interior designer in town, and I changed my tactic. And I basically was like, just give me a chance. I'm going to bring this 54 by 54 painting to you. If you love it, then let's work together. It's the only painting I have, but I can create more like it. And if you don't, then I'll come back to you like a year from now with like a portfolio of work. And so I brought it down there. I borrowed a buddy's truck, brought it down there. He loved it. It sold within a week, and I got my first real check in the mail. It was like, I think it was like $1,400. And I was like, oh my goodness, like this can work. And so Africa and the tornado thing all led me to making that painting that gave me clarity of a route to take. And then from that point on, I kind of became laser focused as treating it as a side hustle while I had a day job, and then just kept building and building and building and building. So that's kind of like a very long answer to your question, but I felt it was worth mentioning those two events.
No, that is awesome. That is such a great story. And like, that's so great. Like everything just seems like it lined up.
Yeah, I was very fortunate in that way.
So after that happened though, so you sold that first painting. The interior decorator obviously was pleased because that worked out. Yeah.
Yeah. That spun into a relationship that lasted for quite a few years. He ended up, it was another luck, just a lucky thing. Like he ended up getting his own HGTV show. And so I got to get on the HGTV show. And so that gave me exposure. And so I started to get like some of my work into like the hands of like celebrities that were local, and also like just being in the music business. Like I already had a lot of contacts in that world. And so I was able to use those connections to help. And then, you know, really what I did for the longest time was, and this was advice that I received from quite a few people who were like entrepreneurs at the time, friends of mine. And they kind of said, you know, you need to treat this as like a business that you snowball into a career. I know it's a romantic idea to just quit your day job and just start this thing because you're having some like, you know, some sales and you're getting up like this momentum, but your dream can quickly become your nightmare if you're not smart about it. I took that advice wholeheartedly, and I decided to, I worked at a company in town called Warner Music. It's a big record label in town. And I just designed t-shirts for like Blake Shelton and all these big name country artists for 8 hours a day in a cubicle. I designed t-shirts for all these people. And then I would go home and paint from like 6 o'clock until midnight. And then when I could, not every day, obviously, I have a wife and I had to like maintain that too. And so that was kind of the gig for a long time. It was just, I had all these random jobs that I would do during the day. But it also, there's an argument to be made that I probably could have become a full-time artist sooner than I had. I've been full-time now for 3 years, but I'm very glad that I went the route of kind of slowly easing into it versus jumping headfirst, because I think I would have become really frustrated and stressed out if I would have jumped in sooner. And I probably would have started creating work that was more urgency type work, just to be able to make ends meet, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's the romantic notion of throwing caution to the winds. It's not just in the art industry, and I think the entrepreneur startup industry as well, that you're going to quit your job and do this thing that you love. It changes drastically when your way of life is now dependent on this thing that used to be a side gig, and you need time for things to percolate and for yourself to sort of find out who you are, in this case, as a painter. I'm kind of curious. So the first painting that you did that you sold was the sort of culmination of the trip to Africa and was largely from memory, but that's not how you paint now. Can you talk a little bit about like how that transition happened?
I actually just came off of a solo show this past Friday, which is when me and you were talking. And so that was like a huge type of celebration for me, because it was just like, it was a crazy week in general. But my current work, I'm always trying to find this balance between, as of right now, of sort of photorealism, but expressionism kind of combined. So I've started adding in the figure to my work as this way of allowing myself to keep backgrounds and landscapes or the water, whatever it is, more vague and loose, but then allowing your eye to kind of fill in the blanks once, because the figure has such tight detail in it. It was just like a natural progression for me. Like I started out only painting with palette knives, doing very super vague interpretations of landscape, very large scale. And then I think just once I started getting into the gallery world and starting to realize that I wanted to never stop growing as an artist, that has just become the natural progression to where I am now. It wasn't anything forced. It just kind of slowly became what it became. And I think that was because I just started to get more comfortable with the materials and understand more foundational type things. And before I was doing the Africa paintings, I was actually doing more tight detail type stuff. I basically went from doing like charcoal drawings, trying to do like these super tight portraits, to then complete abstraction in these landscapes, to now I'm slowly coming back into the tight detail and, you know, still keeping it vague and that sort of thing. My work is very much anchored around the idea of like capturing the vibe or the mood of a place versus it being very specific, and trying to like transport the viewer to being there and forcing them to feel something. And so I'm trying to figure out how to do that with this new style that I'm in.
Who are some of the artists that you were looking at, like when you were kind of trying to figure all that out? Were there artists that you were looking at to sort of inspire you?
For sure. Like, I would find artists online. When I first started out, because I didn't go to art school, like I wasn't really around people. I was surrounded by musicians. So like, I wasn't really like being introduced to any like artists like Sargent or like any like the big name artists. And so I didn't discover those until like way later on. So back then it was like, obviously someone like Andrew Wyeth, like I would go to like Borders bookstores and like just flip through all his books and stuff. And then at some point I came across the artist Gerhard Richter and his like landscape work, not his abstractions, but his landscape work. And so that was like a huge influence on me. But yeah, other than that, there weren't too many. When I was in high school, my sister was obsessed with Van Gogh. And so I too then became obsessed with Van Gogh just because she was so into it. And so that was really like the only artist that I was really into early on. And then later on, it was the Wyeth and the Richter. And those are the ones that really stand out.
You also mentioned that what you're trying to get is the feeling of the place. And I'm kind of wondering, like, if you can sort of connect the dots between Gerhard Richter's landscapes and what you're doing now in terms of, with that objective, in terms of trying to capture the space as opposed to like a more geographical landmarky painting.
For sure. Yeah. I think with his, it was more of the idea of, I felt like what I was seeing, like really captured like atmosphere. It seemed very loose, but at the same time, the mark making, it worked to where you knew it was a landscape, but then there was so much atmosphere to it that it felt like it was connecting me and drawing something out of me. It wasn't like this inspiration of like, oh my gosh, like I saw his work and then like I knew like that's what I wanted to make something similar. It was just kind of like, oh, like it was the first time like I saw somebody creating something in the same vein I saw myself going, that was doing it really well and was like a big name artist. And so that just kind of inspired me in that sense. And so, cause in the beginning, when I was like, went back to like the Rwanda and the Africa paintings, for me, it was like, I just wanted to create a feeling of atmosphere. And what most people didn't even know, it was Africa. That was kind of the similarity that I saw in his work that I was trying to pull off in mine, was the atmospheric vibe to it. And then the direction into the ocean paintings was kind of this progression of like, for a long time I was doing cloudscapes, and it was like 60% of the painting was the sky. And then I would do like these pretty harsh horizon lines that were more abstract in a sense, but then a lot of detail in the sky. And I felt like there was a lot of freedom in painting the skies, because obviously like clouds can be anything. And I think with water, the flow of it, the patterns that are there, there's like a freedom in painting that too, where it almost kind of becomes this abstract thing where you're not tied to a photograph. Like a lot of my ocean paintings, I start out, like I'll get like a reference to try to get the proportions right. And then I figure out my palette, but then I don't tie myself down to a photo at that point. I kind of just let it happen. You know, whatever happens, happens. And And so that's why I've been so kind of still on that idea. I'm slowly kind of getting out of that now, still incorporating water into my work, but I can see my next season of work being less and less water-based, even though the ocean is one of my favorite things to paint. For me, like the ocean, there's like very many ways you can use it as like a metaphor for our lives, where it's like there's like a harshness, a rawness to it. It's very unforgiving. And then on the flip side, it's like this mysteriously beautiful thing that provides for us. I have confession time here. So when I was in Charleston for my show this past week, I decided, like, typically I don't get very anxious or nervous for shows. I'm usually pretty fine around gatherings and groups of people when it comes to a show. But for some reason, I think maybe because this group of paintings was dealing with like some honest type of honesty, that I knew a lot of people were going to be asking me about the paintings, and I was going to have to like keep repeating all these things. And I just, for some reason, had all this like anxiety that was kind of stirred up from it. And so I decided to get up the morning before the show at like 6 a.m. and just go for a run and try to get all that energy out. Of course, it was like freezing cold. And so I just decided to run around the whole neighborhood that we were staying at. And then I ended up at the beach right when the sun was coming up over the ocean. And I'd never seen a sunrise like that. And like leading up to the show, I was thinking a lot about all this like deep stuff. Like, I can't remember who the quote was from, but it basically said like, maybe the journey isn't so much about becoming anything. Maybe it's about unbecoming everything that isn't really you, so that you can become who you're meant to be. Basically, like, our true selves are kind of tainted by like all the data, all the input, all the things coming at us. And we need to like figure out a way to strip that stuff away to find. So anyway, I was thinking about all this like heavy stuff going on with my family, my kids. And as that sun was coming up over the ocean, I haven't cried at like any of my child's births. Like, I just don't ever cry. And I just started like crying, standing there looking at that like a baby. And I was like, what is happening to me? And so it's like, that's why I like painting the ocean. Like, I feel like there's a presence to it. It's ridiculous to say, but I think sometimes, like, if you've ever read like a holy book or a certain novel or something, like the ocean, they know you're reading it, or it knows you're there, and it speaks to you in that moment. And so that connectivity that we all have to the ocean and to a certain landscape is what's so fun about it, because you paint these paintings and most of the time somebody connects to it. What blows my mind every time is like, there's a certain painting that I'm working on where I'm going through something or having like more, maybe like a worshipful moment or a meditative moment on this one particular painting. And that one particular painting in my show will have brought somebody to like an emotional state. That to me is like unbelievable. It's just the ocean. It's just.
But it's powerful. It's a powerful symbol, and it's a powerful, you know, you're right. It's a powerful metaphor for our lives, for who we are, for the change, for the consistency, for all of that at the same time. And I think it does sort of make sense to me. I used to have like a similar thing with the wind. Like, I could just, to me, the wind just felt like it was bringing me, again, I guess, like the kind of confession time, like I was really close to my grandmother. And so like, I just would be like really thinking about something and I'd feel this like really gentle wind come. And I was just like, okay, hey, Nana, you know, I know you're talking to me or whatever. And so like, it was just like a source of like calmness and strength to me. And I think like, you know, at the ocean, it's the same way. You know, I grew up in California, but I didn't grow up next to the ocean. I would try to go as much as I could. But so I guess for me, like the consistency was like the wind for this invisible force. Yeah, that absolutely resonates with me. It's so fascinating, like that, how powerful nature is and what it brings to us and what it, you know, it helps us. I don't know if it's be more humble, but to just be more in touch with who we are on this earth, on this planet, and that, you know, it's not, we can get really self-centered, you know, and feel like it's just like whatever's happening in my head is the entire universe.
Right. Yeah. I think that's part of the reason I got quite emotional in that moment, was because I think I'd been letting myself get caught up in the very, I guess mildly like narcissistic kind of thing, where it's like, you're, especially like as an artist, it's like you find yourself, like you're just continually trying to like promote yourself and get yourself out there. It all becomes about you. And, you know, and with having a family now, like I've just found myself like always still having a lot of love and putting heart into my work, but like a lot of stress building up and like a lot of just life stuff happening all around me, and finding myself like going down certain roads or adapting certain habits that are unhealthy. And so that was like this moment of like clarity for me, of like a realization of like, okay, I need to slow down and like really focus on what's important here and forget all this other BS, all this other stuff that's being projected at me, or that I'm, the insecurities, the self-doubts, like all this stuff that's in the way, just let it go, just abandon it and move on. And when it rears its head again, I'll deal with it. But so I don't know, it was a cool moment.
Walk us through how you kind of approached learning how to paint the way that you do. So, 'cause you have this really, you know, tight, realistic, I don't really want to say, I don't feel like it's hyper realistic. It's a realistic painting style. It's very distinct also. Like you can see who you are in it. And that is something that a lot of artists struggle with, is like, number one, there's the wrestling with the tools and the media. And then number two, actually painting what you want to paint as opposed to what you think people might like.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I definitely don't want to become a hyper-realist painter. Nothing against hyper-realist painters. I have a lot of artists, like the owner of one of the galleries I show is an amazing hyper-realist painter. Or I guess you would call him a surrealist. So my progression into what I'm doing now, I think, was definitely probably influenced by getting into galleries where I was surrounded by people, everybody was better than me in regards to technicality stuff. And so I found myself, because I was always surrounded by, and that was also pretty intentional. My whole life I've tried to surround myself with people who are more talented than me and who are smarter than me, because I've just always thought like that rubs off, and you, it gives like a very, there's sort of like a competition that happens that's a healthy competition, you know, it's like a
inspiration and aspiration, I think.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And so I definitely saw a lot of what all the other artists around me were doing. So that influenced me in regards to having access to them, because like in my head, I always had like an idea of what, for example, like my water paintings, like when I first started painting them, they came out okay, but like, I just didn't know how to get them to the level I wanted them to be. So I was just doing the best that I could. But then because I had access to all these amazing artists who could paint the ocean the way I wanted to paint it, I would just ask them, like, what is your technique? What are you using? And they were luckily open books and gracious enough to give me any advice I'd asked. And so I would just email even artists I didn't know. I would find their work and email them questions. And I've welcome it now, because that's one of the beauties of like Instagram or something, is I'll have like artists just starting out email me, and I love that. I'll send them like a whole page email. I'm like, here's what everyone told me. I hope this helps. And so having that access to other artists that I could ask technical questions to, and then just showing up every day, just showing up every day and trying to figure it out. I didn't have a professor looking over me to help me, like, because it was all on my own. And even back then, like, I didn't even really have YouTube back then. Whereas now, like, you know, you can even, most things you can find online to at least help you, get you in the right direction to then put in the time and figure it out. That's mostly what it was just a natural progression, feeding off of other people, being inspired by other people, and painting lots and lots and lots of crappy paintings to get to where I wanted it to be.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I mean, there's so many quotes, I guess, about that, but what you said about being around people that were more talented or smarter than you, I think there's some quote that gets passed around a lot that, you know, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room or something like something along those lines. The thing is the challenge and the inspiration of it. Like, it's not, like you said, a competitive thing. It's seeing the possibilities and responding to them.
Yeah. Like I said, I don't know what's next stylistically for me, but I do find myself trying to pull it back now because I do see my work becoming a little bit more in the realism world than I want it to be. I'm more attracted to like loose mark making, capturing the essence of a painting without it being super tight. But like I was saying before, like that's one of the reasons that I liked adding in the figure was because I could try to find a balance of the two. I could keep the backgrounds very loose. Like if you're looking at it up close, it's just marks that are the trees or whatever it might be. It's not super tight, but then the figure, the jacket of the whatever the person's wearing, the raincoats are like really tight in detail. And so it's like a fun balance, but I'm just trying to figure that out still of where I want that to go. My work might not look anything like it does a couple of years from now, hopefully.
Hopefully, exactly. That's what we can all hope for.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about your studio practice? Like, what is your sort of habit when you go in?
I'm sure you hear this like constantly from people who have kids. But once we had our second and third kid, I found myself producing better work, more work, and having like a more fruitful career as opposed to before I had kids. And so I think it kind of forced out a lot of the like laziness in me having kids because all of a sudden like I was super disciplined because there's no procrastinating getting up in the morning and feeding the kids and being on this schedule and taking them to their sports and like everything that has to do with it, with raising kids forced me into creating these habits that are now ingrained in me to where like I have to take advantage of every little moment that I have to paint, especially if I have a show coming up or I've committed to certain commissions that are due before a certain date. So currently my studio practice is basically I wake up every day at 6 a.m. to help with breakfast and get the kids off to school. And then I'm in my studio by like 8:45. And then I paint until 2:30. Like most artists, that first hour in the studio is usually just kind of waking up and getting to emails or just sitting there in silence and thinking about things. I typically will paint or just work whatever I'm doing until 2:30. And then on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I come back to my studio at like 6 o'clock and I'll work till like 10:30. So I kind of have a deal worked out with my wife. I'm like, I'll help out with this and this. You help out with that. But you give me Tuesdays and Thursdays, especially if I have like a show coming up, then I have to have at least a couple evenings. And we're in this unique situation right now where we're in between homes. So we're currently living in an apartment where I used to have a home studio. Now my studio is away from home in this old factory here in Franklin. And so it's a lot harder for me to paint at night being away from home. Whereas when I had my home studio, I could just get the kids to bed and then like creep into my studio and work until I wanted. Eventually I'll have a home studio again and I'll be way more productive than I am now. But having those couple evenings really helps. But that's like my typical week is like 9 to 2:30 and then having two evenings.
And how old are your kids?
I have a 2-year-old daughter, a 5-year-old about to be 6, and a 6-year-old about to be 7, 2 boys and a girl.
Oh, wow. So yeah. And at one point, yeah. So then you have 2 that were back to back almost.
Yeah. Basically like, yeah, a toddler and a baby. That was like the hardest season ever.
I imagine.
That was so hard. Yeah. I think we had quite a bit of counseling after that, with my wife. That was a rough season.
Well, yeah. I mean, and I think it's, you know, I like to ask these questions about the kids and about, you know, their ages and stuff, because I think it's going away now, because people are talking about it or, you know, and are asking about it. But there's always like such a weird thing, like you couldn't be a true artist if you had kids because like you couldn't be so focused and blah, 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 which to me is just, it's really sad for the people who, you know, who have kids and feel like, oh, I can't do it because, you know, like I have this commitment with my kids. Obviously, they're the most important thing. And so I guess, like, for the, you know, for the parents who are out there who are struggling to paint, what advice would you have for them?
It's just a season too. Like, when the kids are little, right now it's even way easier for me than it was. Like, when the kids were really little, you know, and my wife works as well. And so for the longest time, until 3 years ago, I had a full-time salary job, and she's always had a full-time job. She's very much not the type of person who wants to be a stay-at-home mom. Like, she loves to work and pursue goals and that sort of thing. And so we're both like that. And so in the beginning, it was just kind of a matter of, like, embracing it. And like I said, you quickly realize that you take so much more advantage of the time that you have, and you start to develop, like, more discipline. I thought, anyway, like, I was, you know, before having kids, it was like we both worked and I was kind of just painting whenever I wanted to paint. You know, I'd be like, oh, I'll just catch up on this Netflix show and work on those painting ideas on the weekend. And so once we had kids, I think it also, like, in a way, it kind of, like, weeds out the people who aren't very serious about painting. Because if you're, like, laser focused and this is your dream and this is what you want to do, you'll find the time to do it, whether it's painting or getting a record deal or starting your own coffee shop, whatever it is, like, that you're pursuing as an entrepreneur or a creative pursuit. Like, if it's really what you want to do, you're going to find time to do it. Or else, you know, for me, whenever I wasn't pursuing it, I was miserable because I knew that that's what I needed to be doing. But as far as it, like, really good advice, it's like, it's hard. It's like everybody's way of, like, parenting and doing things is so different. But for us, it was just like, we got really serious about getting on a schedule, putting the kids on a schedule, so that everything was consistent, not just letting the kids go to bed whenever they were tired. Like, we had a very strict bedtime for the kids so that we could then do the things that we needed to do when they were sleeping. So that was, like, the biggest thing, was sticking to a schedule and communicating with one another so that there were no surprises. Cause then you would get, like, really mad at each other if, like, all of a sudden I got to deal with the kids because, like, you just decided on a whim, like, you're going to go do this thing. It was like, as long as we could, like, be on the same page. Like, if I told her, like, hey, I got a show 6 months from now, so if you give me some room to do this thing, I'm going to be a better husband, I'm going to be a better dad, because I'm going to be able to pursue this thing. And then when that's over, you get to do this thing. It was like always this kind of give and take and being understanding through those pursuits. You know, I don't have that great of advice for that. It's just kind of roll with it and figure it out on your, you know, as you go. That's what I did. I was terrified to be a father. Every kid we've had was a surprise. We weren't planning on 2, and we weren't planning on 3. Apparently, we're terrible at avoiding having kids.
Well, I think, you know, that what you just said, there's a lot of really great advice in there, you know, about communicating with each other and getting the kids on a schedule and yeah, being hyper-focused when you're in the studio, because hands down, that is the one thing I hear over and over again from people, is that they're amazed at how focused they got after having kids. And rather than it being something that kind of pulled them away, it actually, like, was like a laser beam then, you know?
Yeah. Another thing I think that struck me when my kids got a little bit older was I kept being tempted by all these, like, things happening over in my day job. You know, like, when I was at Warner Music, they'd be like, hey, you could be the creative director in, like, 2 years and then do this thing. It was all this, always like this carrot dangling in front of me that was, had something completely not to do with my dream of being an artist over here, but was like the security blanket thing, you know, like, ooh, like, okay, well, I am designing for, like, these big name people and that's cool. And, like, it's, like, artistic in its own way. I was always, like, trying to, like, argue in my mind about these things. And then after having, or like I was saying, our kids got a little bit older, I started to think about, like, the example that I wanted to set, and I want them to see me struggle and pursue my dream and not give up on it. And I didn't want to be like, you know, in my 50s or 60s and my dad's, or and my kids come up to me and be like, you know, dad, mom said it, you used to be an artist at some point, like, you used to love painting, like, why didn't you ever pursue, like, I was always thinking those type of thoughts in my head, like, and I was like, I'm going to pursue this thing and I want to be successful at it so that my kids can see me doing it. and so that I can be that example. So that's like another aspect of having kids that kind of lights a fire under you in a way.
Yeah, the legacy and showing them what's possible.
Right, right.
Yeah, I love that. You reminded me of something. I wanted to kind of circle back to that. You know, like when you first started really pursuing your art, you mentioned that you had all these relationships with, you know, through the music business, and you had created this relationship with the interior designers. I would love to hear your perspective on building relationships and kind of learning to see opportunities where, you know, I think a lot of people might not see opportunities when they're oftentimes there right in front of our faces.
Yeah. I mean, I've always, like I said, like approached it. I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that because I went to school for music business. And then when I got out of college, like I was constantly around other like managers and people dealing with artists, that I got like this firsthand experience on like building connections and like everyone's always trying to like have a relationship over here because this person knows the publisher over here. It was like this constant like networking thing going on. And I was just taking that and then applying it to how can I use all that knowledge in the fine art world. And also like a very much like a self-awareness thing too, of knowing like, this is where my work is at. And this is the level I'm at. Like, how do I approach this in the city that I'm in? My first idea was like, obviously like, all the people that I have around me, they all know this person over here and this person over here. And so the interior design thing, I thought for me was like the smart route at that time, because like I said, there wasn't like an art district here and all the galleries weren't really accepting like young artists. It was more like middle to well-established artists. And even then they weren't really moving work. That's when I had the idea of like, well, there's no shortage of people in the music industry here who have money. There's no shortage of interior designers who are designing their home. Like a lot of these people aren't going into galleries to pick out work for their homes. They're using these interior designers, and it's like a huge industry here. That was like the route that I took that launched me into the idea of it being lucrative. But in regards to recognizing those relationships, I think it just came from being in the music business and seeing how everyone was always kind of networking and trying to think outside of the box of ways to move my art that wasn't in the fine art world. It was like, how do I get my art in front of people that has nothing to do with the gallery scene? I could pursue that later once I get like a portfolio and things together. But for now, I'm just going to reach out to everybody I know and tell them this is what I'm doing now and see what they think. And that kind of helped big time in those early stages.
Yeah. The big takeaway for me in what you said is it would be easy to hear that and be like, oh, I should go to the interior designers. That's what's going to help. But what I'm hearing is not that it's the interior designers. It's looking at what were all the pieces that were available to you where you're living and who are the type of people that are around you and how can you access them? And it just happened to be that interior designers was it. But that kind of thinking, I think it's brilliant because it's taking the tools that you have and really not saying like, okay, I have this one painting and and I'm going to, you know, oh, I can't go to the galleries, or maybe just trying to go to the galleries with the one painting and then getting frustrated that it didn't work out. Or, you know, seeing that as the only route, it's really looking at like, okay, what are all the opportunities that I have? What is the realistic ways that I can apply the tools that I have? And now I'm just going to go in this direction and kind of make that happen.
Yeah, it was definitely that exactly. It was kind of navigating the scene in front of me of people who were selling art. And that was another thing I did that I think helped a lot, was I went into all the like design firms around me that I knew were doing really well. And that was like another connection that I found out through like the music industry, was I reached out to people that I knew had been using designers and whatnot, and basically wrote down on a tablet like 10 like of the top design companies in Nashville. And before I even approached the designers themselves, I went through there and wrote down like all the art and the artists that were already in there, and then reached out to those artists, asking them about their relationship with them, if they're moving a lot of art, those sort of questions. And then that was able to narrow my list down to like six. And then from those six, five of them laughed at me. And then one was the guy that kind of helped me get my start. So
brilliant. I love it. How were you feeling when you were doing that? I'm just out of curiosity. Do you remember kind of what was going through your head?
Yeah, it was embarrassing. Like I knew I needed to do it. If I was going to do it, like that was the moment to do it. Cause I knew that like, I knew that I had struck onto something with that painting. It was the first time I was like super confident in like a painting. And I was like, now this is now or never. Like, you know, I was making money with going on tour and stuff like that. So I was like, I know it's not going to like hurt me to do this. And also like I was living in a house full of like artists and musicians. It was this very unique time where I was just in this house full of these musicians who have now gone on to be in big bands, and like we're all still connected. And my best friend Michael, who I lived with at the time, just did a huge favor for me and played at the end of my show. But we all were like that. We were all like always hustling and like doing stuff outside the box, and like we weren't afraid to ask for favors. And like looking back on that whole experience, I'm like, oh my gosh, like what they probably thought of me coming in there. I think I went to Kinko's and I printed off like these terrible pictures of stuff that I had painted. And then I tried to back then, obviously I didn't know really about like scanning an artwork or having it professionally photographed. So the photos were terrible that I was showing them. And so that's when I changed my tactic, and I was like begging them, like, just let me bring the painting in for you to look at it, and I will stop bothering you. I mean, that's been my approach even with like the galleries that I'm still in today. Like I heckled them like crazy, knowing damn well like I had no right being in that gallery at the time. The gallery just had my show at. They said no to me quite a few times. And then I was like, well, can I be in a group show? And so they finally let me into a group show. I was probably so annoying to them.
I'm laughing because that's pretty much how I got my job at Disney. I would just like, oh my God, I harassed them. So like, oh.
Yeah, sometimes that's what it takes, you know. Just gotta harass somebody until they give you a shot.
I love it. It's so funny. I'm trying to think, like, so I was just thinking of asking you about, you know, some of your characteristics and habits that you think have contributed to your success, but I kind of feel like you've kind of answered that without being asked it.
Just be overly arrogant and annoying. Do not do that.
Well, overly arrogant and annoying. I doubt it if you barged in. Like, so walk us through that to actually like seriously, how did that look? So that gallery turned you down several times. Yeah.
Yeah. I was definitely not approaching it in an arrogant sense, but I got really lucky with, so the gallery that I am speaking of is called Robert Lang Studios in Charleston, South Carolina. And Charleston, South Carolina is like a soaring art town. Like if anyone out there is looking for a city to approach for their work that has a big audience of collectors, Charleston has been amazing for me, but also because of this specific gallery. They're like I've never been in a gallery like that. I've been in a lot of galleries, like just kind of in different cities, and especially from touring, like I would always go in and out of galleries, and the experience there is so unique. It's almost like there's like a lot of wonder in there. They have it set up as like an experience versus like just art on the walls. So it's like Easter eggs everywhere, like things to find and explore. There's like a swing. Every kid that comes in, they give them like a junior sketch pad. And it's like this whole experience that they've cultivated there, like a amazing culture. But anyway, I got really lucky because it just so happened that they were the type of gallery owners who were looking for someone who was like a good human being first and a good artist second. And so I went to Charleston for like 3 months and lived there. And while I was there, I knew like this is like a town that I got to get into. And I found them, they were a new gallery. But my approach to them, getting back to that, was a confidence in my work of knowing like obviously, like, my work's going to get better. Like, I'm very dedicated to this. You can count on me. I have the character you're looking for in an artist type of thing. And so once I got invited to that group show, I took full advantage of that, made sure I was there, met them, tried to build a relationship with them so that they would see the type of person that I am. And my whole life has been like, every job I've ever had is like, it's been me just trying to prove myself in the position, having no experience at all in the position, and just people taking a chance on me because of my approach and my, the kind of impression that I was giving off in the beginning of the relationship. So yeah, that's been my whole career so far, is just people taking a chance on me and then me having no idea what I'm doing and then just figuring it out once I got the opportunity.
I love the sort of the initiative that you have, and just kind of the reason why I asked you that question about how exactly did you go up to this, because I was pretty sure that you didn't go in there with all guns blazing and all arrogant and annoying. Because yeah, otherwise, I don't think you'd be having a show right now.
Yeah, right.
You'd probably be banned from Charleston. So on the flip side of that, what has been the biggest struggle for you in this journey so far? Like, that's really been challenging for you, either technically or just kind of mentally, mindset wise?
Man, I have a lot of those struggles for sure, mentally, internally, that is then directly correlated to my practice. It's not so much in the line of technical things, but I think sometimes I feel like I can't be creating if there's like not like a purpose behind what I'm doing. So sometimes I feel lost in my purpose. Like sometimes I feel like the story I'm trying to tell behind the paintings, not that every painting has to have some kind of deep meaning behind it or story to tell. I definitely create paintings to just be creating paintings. But long term, I sometimes get burnt out or frustrated with trying to make sure that there's like a purpose behind what I'm doing. I think that's also like influenced by just going through life and having a family and struggling with my faith, or having people in my inner circle that are struggling and things going on with them. It's like sometimes when life is hard, that will pour out into my work to where then that becomes frustrating. So it's been for sure like a hard season over the past couple of years of navigating what is my work supposed to mean? Like what's the story I'm trying to tell? And so with every success then comes like for sure a moment for me of like, oh my gosh, what am I doing? And there's also like those self-doubts that creep in for me that I think a lot of us have, whether we want to admit it or not, of like when you're an artist, of like, okay, you see all your friends around you in these careers, you know, and they're excelling and they're like moving up and you're like just starting to like get some traction. And then, you know, you might have like, you know, I've definitely had tons of like failures and things that just didn't work, especially with having like being responsible with the weight of like a family. There are times where I'm like, what am I doing? Am I really going to like just create paintings for like the next 30 years and this is going to be what I do? Like, so I have those self-doubts come in all the time, and I'm just always reminding myself like of why I love doing what I'm doing. And I'm always like trying to make sure that I have time to meditate, to find quiet and focus on being present with my kids and my wife, and like do anything I can to create that healthy mental state. Because if I don't, I start to go down that road of the self-doubts and the spiraling. And so, yeah, for me, I think it always comes down to purpose. Like, what's the purpose of what I'm doing?
Yeah, the kind of the question I'm always asking myself lately is, what is this for? What's it for?
Yeah, and it's funny, like everybody I talk to, like, you know, my best friend who has written all these hit songs for all these artists and doing all these great things, he still has these moments where he's like, what am I doing? Like, crap. Has this been like a fool's pursuit? And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, you just did this thing over here. You know, it's like these lies that we tell ourselves.
Well, I'm glad you're sticking it out, and I'm glad I got to have a chance to talk with you and get to know you. Thank you, Adam.
No, thank you, Andrews. This has been awesome.
If you like this podcast, I'd really appreciate it if you'd take just a few minutes and leave a review for me on Apple Podcasts. It is super easy to do, and it makes the podcast easier for other people to find. If you're not sure how to leave one, all you need to do is go to savvypainter.com/review. I made step-by-step instructions for you. It would mean so much to me, and I thank you in advance for that. The Savvy Painter podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Pandora, Stitcher Radio, and just about every podcast app out there. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Savvy Painter podcast with Adam Hall. As always, you can find show notes for this episode at savvypainter.com/podcast. You'll find examples of Adam's paintings there, along with links to connect with him and details about his show that is up right now at the Robert Lang Studios in Charleston, South Carolina. And once again, that runs until November 22nd, 2019. So until the next time, this is Antrese Wood with the Savvy Painter podcast. Thank you so much for listening.